arranging the show. I'm also the sound engineer for tonight, so if you can't hear things, let me know and I'll put the sound up. Over to you, Don.
Thanks, Chris. Can everybody hear me? Is everybody in here from the food room? Because it looks like there's some
Yeah, okay.
Thank you, everybody, for coming tonight. I'm Jonathan Abrams. I'm an entrepreneur, and it's my pleasure to moderate this this panel on Lean Startups tonight. So this is, I believe, S-Face's first ever San Francisco event, and I want to thank Cooley Godward. Who else is here from Cooley? Raise your hand. Anybody? Thank you very much for hosting us. And thanks as well to the S-Face team for giving in to me bugging you guys to have a San Francisco event. After a while, it's fun to be doing something in San Francisco, which is now where I live and work. But I actually started off in Silicon Valley, and I went to my first S-Face event probably around, I think, like 13 years ago when I first moved to Silicon Valley and didn't know anything about startups or entrepreneurship. How many people here know what S-Face is? Okay, most of you. Good. So S-Face is a nonprofit supporting entrepreneurship and startups in Silicon Valley and now San Francisco. There's a ton of S-Face programming every month. Opportunities to meet investors, panels, educational events. Go to sface.org on the internet and you can learn all about it. But it's a great organization and a non-for-profit, so often providing, I think, pretty cost-effective events, which fits in pretty well to the Lean model. And you should all go, if you aren't familiar with S-Face, get on the mailing list, learn about the events, become a member if you want, come to the events, and check it out and see what they have to offer. So tonight we have a really great panel that I'm excited about, and I think a pretty timely topic, and S-Face gave in to me wanting to do an event on this topic, so if you don't like it, it's my fault. But I thought that this is a very timely and interesting interesting topic, the topic of Lean Startup. So first I'm going to introduce our wonderful panel, who I also want to thank for being here. So immediately to my left, we have Steve Blank, who I think is a pretty famous guy. And I think some people would agree. One of the...
My wife doesn't think so.
Your wife's not here?
I still haven't taken out the garbage.
So Steve, I think, is one of the people who's really been sort of, I think the word thought leader, that sounds kind of silly, but instigator maybe behind behind some of this whole Lean Startup stuff. And he is the author of this book. This is my personal copy. This book is The Four Steps to the Epiphany. And it, of course, is available on Amazon.com. And I'm still slogging through it and rereading it myself and trying to understand it. It's not an easy book, but it's a very, very, very interesting and useful book that I actually would recommend to any entrepreneur. It's also been recommended by Mark Andreessen and Venture Hacks and many other folks. And as Steve, for some reason, likes to brag about, he's been involved in many different startups, some of which he calls craters, some... home runs, some base hits. He's had a pretty long career with a lot of different companies, and he actually has been blogging about the history of Silicon Valley on his blog. And I think one of the companies he's most famous for is Epiphany, which was one of the early enterprise marketing automation and CRM companies around 10 years ago. More recently, he's really been giving back and teaching at Stanford, Berkeley, a whole bunch of places, writing the book. And I think he's been a mentor to a lot of folks, including Eric Ries, who's probably the guy, I think, who sort of coined or has popularized this whole Lean Startup concept.
Trademarked and registered.
Yeah. Next, we have Rob Hayes, who is general partner at First Round Capital, which is one of the VC firms that I'm fond of and respect. I've never gotten money from them yet, but maybe in the future. But I think First Round is also, maybe you could call them sort of a lean VC. They are definitely one of the newer firms. They don't have billions of dollars under management, and they have really invested in small and nimble and early stage companies, and I think have done some innovative things in the venture industry, which is not an industry that's actually known for its internal innovation, even though it supposedly funds innovation. Previously, he worked at Midyar Network. I think you were the first venture investor for the Midyar Network, which, of course, from Pierre Midyar. And before that, he was at Palm, originally as a product manager, and I think ended up starting their venture group as well. So so Rob has a quite a long history with some really interesting stuff on the investor side, and he's, I guess, our token VC on the panel. A lot of times these events have like five VCs, and you know, probably not good to do that, but I think we've got one good one, so it's going to be interesting to get his perspective on that. Next, we've got Craig, who I guess is our token lawyer. Craig Jacoby from Cooley Godward, our hosts, and I asked him what he wanted me to say, and he was also very humble. I think he's trying to be like Steve or something, and he's like, oh, you know, I'm just helping start. But he is has actually Stanford Law, worked, I think, at Cooley for, well, a long time, like 15 years or something?
Getting up on 13 years.
13 years. And has he works with early stage startups here in San Francisco, so very much the kind of companies that would be employing lean startup techniques. And some of the companies that he's worked with include Yelp, Olive, the company that makes the Jawbone method, that makes the sort of, you know, non-ruining the environment stuff to use in your bathroom and kitchen and home. So he's got a pretty pretty deep experience working with startups, obviously, for 13 years doing this kind of stuff. Next, we have Rashmi from SlideShare, and I guess I'd say you're the token entrepreneur, although I'm an entrepreneur as well, so we've got two. Rashmi is the founder and CEO of SlideShare. How many people here know what SlideShare is? That's good. And full disclosure, I'm an angel investor in SlideShare, so I don't know if that presents a conflict of interest of some kind. SlideShare is obviously a great site for hosting presentations and slides and documents. And then we have Sean Murphy, and Sean, you're a consultant, right?
Yes.
So you're the token consultant.
I'm the token consultant, yes.
And Sean actually works with early stage companies, helping them with early traction with customers, and he's also one of the sort of, I guess, proponents and thought leaders in this whole lean startup concept.
I'm kind of a refrigerator bulb next to Eric, but you know, I try and shed my own little light out there. So.
That's hot. Why are you guys laughing? This is like a serious topic. So, thank you all again for being here. We sold out the capacity we had tonight. I think it's because of this this excellent panel that agreed to talk with us. So, how many people here are an entrepreneur? But, okay, so it's a pretty entrepreneurial crowd. And how many people already know what this lean startup concept even is?
Okay, we're done.
Okay, so not everybody. Not everybody. So we get right into this. I'm going to start quick by quoting from Eric Reese. And Eric was out of town, unfortunately not able to be here for this event today. But he's been sort of, I think he, from what I remember, the first person to sort of coin this, the term lean startup. And actually, I'm kind of curious whether Steve would agree. So he had a blog post, and for those who don't know, Eric is an entrepreneur, and I think he was a student of Steve's. And one of the companies that he developed some of these concepts for, is it IMVU or MVU? How do you pronounce it?
Either one.
Either.
As long as you buy something from there.
Well, MVU or IMVU, and as the part of the process of being a founder of that company, he started working with these techniques, and he articulated in a blog post on September 8, 2008. And is this correct? Would you say that's was the first sort of articulation of this?
In public,
okay. So Eric wrote, and by the way, Eric's blog is startuplessonslearned.com. And if you're interested in the topic we're discussing tonight, you'd probably want to be reading his blog. So Eric wrote, I've been thinking for some time about a term that can encapsulate trends that are changing the startup landscape after some trial and error settled on the lean startup. And he basically says, I'm talking about lean in the sense of low burn, taking advantage of open source, agile software, iterative development, and implementing lean thinking, and really also talking about customer-centric rapid iteration. And that also is a lot of what this book is about. So, the four steps to the epiphany, and actually, Steve is going to This is kind of exciting. He's going to be telling us about the secret fifth step tonight. Do not blog about that.
Have 10 minutes to make one up.
This book, Steve talks about something he calls customer development, and talking about how us geek entrepreneurs often very focused on product development and often lacking in customer development. And I think part of the whole concept of the lean startup is trying to actually figure out if the idea you have to build actually is anything anybody would be interested in, want, pay for, etc. before you go off and spend 2 years and $10 million in VC funding building it. So Steve talks about customer development, which is a whole process for developing and validating the customers, the market for a product. And I think that also is then one of the components with this lean startup concept that Eric Ries articulated. So that, in a nutshell, is my sort of stealing from other folks explanation of what this lean startup concept is about, and obviously we're going to explore that in quite a bit more detail. So I'm going to start off actually before I forget with Sean, because before we began, Sean was making a comment about that there was sort of a VC fund backed side of the panel versus not, because I think Sean is working a lot with companies that are not either VC funded, not even necessarily seeking VC funded, and he actually made a comment that I completely agree with, that many times companies or entrepreneurs are focused way too early on, you know, I've got an idea, boom, VC funding, rather than a lot of other intermediate steps. And he was pointing out that on the other side, we've got, you know, the VC, and I think, Steve, most of your companies have been venture-backed, and I found the three companies all venture-backed. So I'm going to ask Sean, is this concept of the lean startup somehow incompatible with venture funding?
No, so I think lean is about creating value, and value is what your customer gets out of the product, not what you put into it, right? I think it's compatible with raising funding as long as you bear in mind you've got to have a plan that deserves investment. And these days, that means typically customer substantiation, customer revenue. So the problem is not VC funding per se, it's that people go for it before they've really got validation that they've got something that they can actually scale. And the typical driver is, I need a salary, or, you know, I'm out of money, so I'm going to raise money in this. There was a great quote at startup school by one of the 37 Signal guys that the bootstrapping folks are trying to raise money from customers, and the VC-backed folks are trying to spend money as fast as they can. So anyway.
Well, I think that is a true statement. Sean, you also involved in, is it you the bootstrapper?
We do six of these a month now. You're welcome to come. They're for folks that are bootstrapping. We focus on organic revenue growth and the problems associated with that. It's a peer-to-peer conversation around a table, 7:30 in the morning or 9 in the morning.
So a terminology question I'm going to ask, not to get caught up in it, but just to sort of clarify again. What's the difference in your mind between bootstrapping, which is not a new term, I think we've heard that term for a long time, and although it's, I think people often view bootstrapping as something temporary, like I'm bootstrapping because I have to until I someday get enough traction to get venture funding. So what is the difference between bootstrapping and being a lean startup, or is it overlapping, or is it the same?
So I think they're different aspects of the same coin. A lot of people bootstrap because they want to be in absolute control of their company, right? And I think one of the aspects of lean, in addition to focusing on customer value creation, is, are you learning rapidly? Are you learning how you're going to create value? Are you learning where the market is, right? And not all bootstrappers do that, obviously. With the breakfast and other ways, we encourage them to focus on learning faster than their competition, because that's one of the few reasons that you can actually outperform your competition over the long run. But not everybody that bootstraps a business wants to learn faster. Some want to be in control. So that's probably maybe one difference.
So is this concept, the lean startup, that I guess Eric talked about only around a year ago on his blog, and that obviously a lot of people have been talking about since, including myself, is this anything really new?
So I think I had something to do with it last time. I spoke to Eric. The origins of Lean Startup actually came out of Eric's hard work at IMVU. Eric had taken my class at Berkeley, as mentioned, only as a condition of me funding his partner. His partner, Will Harvey, had been my VP of engineering in a previous company, and I had funded his last company called Bear, which went down the tubes. And I told Will I was never going to write another check unless he actually learned how to build a company. Why don't you sit through my class? Because at least here's one methodology. I don't care what you use, but you got to figure out how to talk to customers. And he drug along his new minted co-founder, a guy named Eric Ries. And on the drive back from Berkeley to Palo Alto, the conversation would always go from Will to Eric. Will, my dear friend, would say, "Boy, that was a waste of time." And Eric would go, "What are you talking about? Look, we got to go do this and this and this." And Will finally gave up and said, "Well, you go implement this stuff." And Eric, over the next N years at IMVU, built an agile methodology for engineering, at the same time wearing the customer development hat. That actually built the processes to engage customers out of the building. And so Eric was probably the first practitioner from day one of an integrated customer development, which I define as the activities outside the building, with an agile development process activities inside the building. And, you know, I told him, "You ought to write this up." And after enough prodding, he came up with a term, lean startup, which I thought was spectacular. And Eric's been out, as you know, evangelizing the concept. So to me, agile development is, lean startup is the sum of a out-of-the-building customer development process coupled with a internal engineering process. It could be agile if it's software. It could be lean manufacturing if you're building cars. It doesn't matter. It just means it's some process that works well together with the very quick, iterative, and constant customer contact and input part of the customer development. So, I don't even remember what the question was, but I answered.
Well, the question was actually, is this whole lean startup racket, is this really anything new? And on your blog, you've recently been sharing some of your, you know, old stories about when you were working at all these companies that go back even before my time. And a lot of entrepreneurs that I talk to don't even know what I'm talking about. When I talk about Netscape, they think I'm talking about the DID clone. But you've talked about your CEO saying, basically, you said, "You're get out of here." He threw you out of the building to go talk to the customers, which is what you were just talking about, the out-of-the-building customer development. So you were obviously doing that long before.
So the for those of you who read that text, let me start by apologizing and making you slog through one of the densest, most turgid things you could ever find. It was a catharsis. The entertaining parts got removed because it would have been even denser. And those were the war stories that are now in my blog, which actually illustrate how some of these concepts of customer development came about. And they were basically based on things I learned in my career. But to be fair, to specifically answer with my professor hat on, almost every idea in each one of the four steps is built on lots of research and work by lots of other people. Von Hippel for customer discovery, you know, Barron's work in company building, etc. And you could find that whole bibliography if you're interested on my blog. There's a link to startup bibliography. And you'll see there's been, for the last 20 or 30 years, experts in each one of those steps. In fact, Clayton Christensen was the guy who kind of approached the notion of market type. He called it disruptive and sustaining innovation. I think in customer development is the first time those pieces had all come together from a practitioner rather than a professor. You know, having got my teeth kicked in by screwing it up and getting fired and whatever, the customer development process was really a synthesis of both my experience and some of the great research done before. So, did I actually answer a question?
Do you guys think you answered it?
Sorry.
I think your answer was sort of.
All right. I'm getting old. I forgot the question again.
So, Rob, let's talk about your perspective from the VC world. So, you guys have been funding stuff really early stage, right? That's you know what you guys like to do, and a lot of VCs say that on their website. And in reality, unless you're famous, they don't. You know, they're not really going to do a lot of stuff at the early stage. First round, that has been one of your focuses. So, from your perspective, is there anything new here? Is this lean startup concept really something that a lot of the companies you guys have been funding since the inception, an approach that most of them have taken, or is this actually an approach that may make some companies not seek venture funding?
So I think the lean startup is a very specific methodology that falls into a larger bucket that we talk about, and maybe it's just a different vocabulary that we use in the VC world. But the reason we started our fund was because we saw a certain class of companies that have become extremely capital efficient over the last, kind of call it 10 years. And a lot of that just had to do with kind of the technology and infrastructure costs of the company. So whereas an internet company in 96 was buying Sun servers and Oracle databases and bandwidth was really expensive, and you could even call it bandwidth, but it was something, but you were using modems and all the rest. To a point, a couple of years ago where you were using, open source databases and commodity servers and bandwidthless for all intents and purposes free, to today where you've got these cloud solutions where in a weekend with a credit card you can open up a massive data center. And so at the same time that this class of company was becoming more capital efficient, venture funds were getting bigger. And that creates a problem because the size of a check that a venture fund can write is highly correlated with the size of the fund. And so the bigger fund you are, the bigger initial check you have to write. The bigger initial check you write has implications about the valuation of that company. The valuation of that company is indicative of the stage of the company. And so what happened was we went from a situation where a traditional, quote, Series A firm that used to write checks to very early stage companies, a couple of people starting something up, moved to a place where they would, the answer would always be, come back when you have more customers, come back when you have revenue, come back when come back when you've taken all the risk out of it.
Of the last five investments that you've made, how much was the size of the investment, and what stage were the companies at? Did they have revenue? Did they have a product development? Fell out? Where were they?
So our average investment size is about $600,000. Our initial investment size.
And would that be the total size of the round?
The total round would be often about double that, right? So we syndicate almost everything we do, but they're in varying stages. But one of them was one guy, with an idea and a couple of advisors. We tend to fund a lot of things that I like to say are two guys and a dog, right? And so sometimes there are real company, they have a company with a real product. Sometimes they even have people using the product. It's rare that they actually have revenue. But there are companies that essentially can't, if they work at all from day one, they generate revenue, and we'll invest in those too. We're not afraid, we don't dislike revenue, right? It's potentially a good thing. In terms of the lean startup is one class of company that fits in this capital efficient company that we're seeing more and more of. But it's a set of methodologies that people have been talking about for a long time. But the tools and technologies that you have today allow you to do better lean startups than you could have done 5 years ago. You can't get the feedback from your customers. Today you get feedback from your customers instantly, and you could be testing it real time. And 10 years ago, when I was building software on kind of 12 to 18 month cycles, that was really hard.
But you sometimes invest before that testing, before that utilization of the internet and other technologies is actually used.
Yeah, because we believe that the team is going to be able to figure that out.
So the capital efficiency was really part of the premise of your whole firm.
Right.
And that capital efficiency was one of Eric Ries's, I think, big concepts and part of this lean startup concept. The other stuff about the customer development and using these tools and stuff like that and really testing things first before getting funded, it sounds like it's a mix. That sometimes you have invested in companies that are already having traction, that are already built something and getting user feedback, and sometimes it's before that.
Right. Yeah, the reality is that there are some people that, and there are some companies that they're tough to bootstrap unless you're already independently wealthy, right? And so, and the amount of money that we're putting into a company, the early days of the company, is enough to test that proposition, right? And it's to, you know, we talk about our initial investment as being about validating the founder's hypothesis.
Sean, what do you think of that? You earlier talked about people going for funding just because they sort of needed the salary. I mean, what do you think about the idea?
So I think first round is somewhat atypical in their approach, even today, right? I mean, you structured the firm to be able to handle rounds that size.
Yeah.
I mean, you're they're an outlier in the distribution of most VC funds. I think. I'm sorry, I'm not using the mic. So I said first round is probably atypical in their ability to support rounds that size and their ability to kind of work with companies that early on. I would say you're in the 1% of the curve, probably,
yeah,
that are able to do that. So I don't think he's a, I don't, I mean, I love what they're doing. I don't think it's representative of most of the venture activity.
Right. Well, it's true. I mean, you know, the vast majority of Sand Hill Road are the guys who raise the huge funds, and obviously that is contracting now, but we're making, as Rob said, increasingly large investments just because of the math of their fund. Of course, there are, you know, probably 10 other firms that do the small deals as well. Of course, representing out of the whole venture industry, you know,
right,
it's a minority.
I think you're going to see a whole new class of venture funds in the next 10 years that don't replace what Rob or the traditional VCs are doing, but actually take advantage of the fact that it's not just cheap hardware or cloud, but it's in fact a whole new process of both agile development, customer development, and this cheap hardware. And again, I'm not pitching these, but I use them as an example of something that I think is very interesting emerging. Y Combinator, Techstars, etc., are low-cost, low-burn experiments. On top of that, people like Maples Investments, and they don't... They're not substitutes for what Rob does, or because they don't have the capital, and but they are more attuned to these models where, you know, Mike Maples' line is 500 grand is a new 5 million. You know, if you have 5 million, maybe you'd say 5 million is the new 50 million. But I just want to point out, I think the venture industry itself is changing and bifurcating yet again in a way that might be interesting to look back and say, was just this some bizarre experiment, or is this really a new tier of venture? I just want to throw that out.
Rob, have you invested in any deals that were first backed by YC, or Y Combinator, or one of those
Absolutely.
Other
Absolutely. So we're investors in a company called Zavvi, which was exactly that. Well, actually, it wasn't exactly that because it was downloaded software, and so it was harder. So they had to actually build into the software. Sorry, Zavvi is downloaded software. It's not a web service. And so they actually had to build into the application, you know, the kind of testing harness to get feedback from the customers. But the application does actually call home and give you know, kind of feedback and metrics. So they do try to stay close to the customer. Because it is downloaded software, they aren't able to iterate as quickly as you are on a website because you have so many different configurations on the other side that the testing burden is much higher. But certainly, you know, going back to the days when I was doing downloaded software, they are orders of magnitude faster in their iterations than we ever were back in the day.
Cool. So it sounds like you guys like capital efficient startups, but you still are investing even in that sort of niche within the venture industry at different stages. I mean, from nothing to having, you know, a Y Combinator company or something further along. It sounds like
it's generally our money is generally the first money that goes in the company, or at least the first institutional money that goes into the company. And different companies have bootstrapped their sales to different places in the spectrum, and that's generally reflected in the valuations that you see. In terms of thinking about the fundraising cycle of that company, we're almost always in the same stage, which is the first institutional investment. I wanted to bring up one other thing about the lean startup and capital efficiency and large funds versus small funds and everything else. There's another piece of this, which is not just how much money you need in the beginning, but getting caught up in the fund math of large venture funds when you're trying to exit. So, you know, large venture funds require billion or multi-billion dollar exits for their investments for them to be successful. There's a lot of companies out there that, you know, aren't going to be billion-dollar startups, maybe don't want to be billion-dollar startups, and maybe want to preserve their optionality along the way. To have, you know, smaller exits and such. One of the things that I think is also good about not just, you know, I'm not just trying to pitch my fund. I tell a lot of companies that they should bootstrap. They're going to be a $20 million exit. And a $20 million exit when you own all the equity in the company is a fairly substantial exit. And whereas to your average Sand Hill Road VC, that's a massive failure.
Right.
When I try to give advice on should you raise money or should you not, it really depends on can you be aligned with your investors, and if your investors have a different set of goals than you do, and their fund math doesn't match up with the company you're building, then you shouldn't raise money from that investor. You should find a investor or another way to get your company going.
Right, and I think part of the lean startup concept is to preserve that optionality, and only raise the money when you actually have some degree of confidence already that the math now is going to justify it,
right,
rather than, you know, raise $20 million, find out, you know, it's your idea really has a potential this much, and now realize that if it had been capitalized completely differently, it might have worked out well, but now it probably will never. So, Craig, you've been very quiet so far. you've been doing this for like 13 years, working with startups. From your perspective, is there anything new going on here? I mean, you've been working with a lot of companies for enough time to go through, you know, before the dot-com boom, through that, now Web 2.0, crash.
One of the first companies that I saw that seemed to be putting a lot of this stuff in place, oddly enough, was way back in 2000 when I was doing a deal on the other side of Amazon. And they were a public company at the time and a pretty big operation, and we were working on a deal where we were representing ToysRUs.com, and this was the deal when they became the Toy Tab at Amazon, which is a very interesting deal to work on. Didn't work out that well in the end, but it was pretty innovative when they were doing it, and it left us with a lot to think about in terms of, you know, one company was giving up their entire, you know, Toys R Us was giving up their entire back end operation, and Amazon was giving up all of its kind of own toy store, and each of them felt that those things were very core to their company at the time. So, but dealing with the Amazon folks and just the way they talked about all the A/B testing that they were doing, and you know, they knew that this color would work here, and you know, this is in the context of different kinds of merchandising decisions that you know, my client, ToysRUs.com, certainly felt that they had some proprietary knowledge about. It was just incredibly interesting to see the degree to which these Amazon folks were testing and finding out what customers cared about, what worked, and what didn't. And I mean, that's not the full concept here, but it's interesting that you don't have to be a small company to be really thinking about iterating, and figuring out what works for customers. And you know, one of the things that I have heard Rob talk about his asses. This is that, you know, what is it? It's a kick-ass team,
big ass market.
Yeah. There's another ass in there somewhere, I thought.
No, that was Claudia.
Is this something serious or a joke?
No, well, this is serious. These are things that you look for, and it strikes me that just this whole model, a lot of entrepreneurs come to us and to other advisors saying, all right, well, you know, can you help me with a business plan? Can you help me write something up? And a business plan, it's important, and obviously, you know, you need to be able to think carefully about your business, but having an approach like this really puts a lot more, from an investor standpoint, it seems that you're really investing much more in the team and in a very generalized area in which they're going to operate, because the whole point is, if you knew your path, you know the direction you're going, but you don't necessarily know the path, and you really have to have a lot of faith in the team to discover that path and to figure out how you're going to get there. So in some ways it changes a little bit. It to some extent stacks the deck a little bit more against a first-time entrepreneur, and it really helps a later stage entrepreneur who's done it, who has a certain level of trust with investors, and where investors understand a little bit more about how they think through things and their thought process. And I think it's I think it does hurt the first-time entrepreneur who needs to get the confidence of an investor that they can navigate through all these things.
Steve, are you about to completely disagree?
Slightly. I was just reminded of a comment Andy Ratcliffe, who used to be a VC at Benchmark, made to me when I was testing this idea out on him. I said, well, you know, how come you don't want all your startups to succeed. And Andy, you know, just did some math for me. He said, Steve, imagine we had 10 deals in our portfolio and they each made us $10 million. But if I, in fact, could have each one of them swinging for the fences, and 8 failed, but 2 brought in $100 million each, that's better math for me. So it just made me realize that the math that investors are doing are not exactly the same math that is, you only have one company.
Mm-hmm.
And with all due respect, and I don't think any VC would disagree, they're operating across the IRR of a portfolio. And so what their needs are, whether you swing for the fences or whether they're a firm going for singles, is something an entrepreneur nowadays ought to just ask. You know, what's the culture of your firm? And if you're taking money for some, let's just use Sequoia, because I love them, but that's a swing for the fence firm. And you go in there and say, well, let me tell you about my methodology of being thoughtful. I don't think so, right? Let me think about this some more. You know, well, that was a nice meeting. What the hell happened? I'm in the parking lot. They want to know that, you know, you're going to live, breathe, bleed, you know, whatever direction you're going. And because their calculus is, yeah, may make it, may not. I really like these guys, but I don't care. At the end, I have an IRR I need to meet. And is that a fair comment?
Right. Absolutely fair.
All right. So that was a real, excuse the pun, epiphany for me, is understanding that the calculus I was doing of, I only have one of my company, versus the calculus my VCs are doing, which is, I like them, but I don't like them that much. I got 10 of them. It's just something to keep in the back of your mind about why not everybody, at least on the investing side, with big funds, loves this. You would think everybody would want you to survive. Not really, because you're a pain in the ass if you're a $10 million company who's in the land of the living dead for the life of the portfolio. You're like creating more VC overhead than you are profit.
Yeah, if you do the fund math, if you do the fund math for a typical $400 million fund, which is an average size venture fund, much bigger than our fund, but you know, a good return is considered is a 3x multiple on the fund, so return $1.2 billion. Add fees and everything else on top of that, it's about $1.5 billion. Average venture guy owns 20% of the company upon exit. So that's $7.5 billion of market cap that's created out of one fund to have an excellent return. So if you had one fund that had MySpace, Skype, and YouTube in it, you'd be halfway there. This gives you an idea of kind of how you know, a lot of traditional venture people think. They need massive, massive, massive wins to show that success.
And
you're right, at $10 million exit.
The numbers just aren't there.
Which, you know, for like a $50 million exit, which is really hard, is absolutely meaningful to someone that has like, you know, $10,000 in their bank account and is driving a used Prius, right? And yet to a venture guy, that's a failure.
Right. And I mean, I think that the math that Steve and Rob are both talking about is very important to the entrepreneur, because obviously the math for you is very different than the math for the fund. But, you know, the other layer of this is that, as Rob's pointed out, the exits aren't even there. I mean, that the numbers that the venture industry needs in the M&A market, the acquisition market, or the IPO market, it's just not there, and it's not going to be. And looking backwards over the last 10 years, this model of swinging and try to, you know, shoot for, you know, one Google in your portfolio, and in the process of pushing, you know, half the company that could have been a $10 million company probably to go to business, the whole model hasn't worked, because the venture industry as a whole for 10 years now has actually not produced great returns. So this model isn't even actually working. It happens to be the math that the funds have to pursue to justify the whole premise, but the math, it just isn't working. Rashmi, so you are an entrepreneur. We haven't heard from you yet. Your company is now venture-backed. I was an angel investor before you guys had venture backing, and before I ever was approached to invest, I really encountered SlideShare as a site that was up and running with a real product that I, as a customer, used and said, "Hey, this is really awesome," and you know, and did that. Versus so many entrepreneurs, and I think Sean mentioned this earlier. I get approached often by young entrepreneurs who say, "Oh, Jonathan, I have some idea. I want your advice. Can you introduce me to 10 VCs? How do I get funded?" And it's like, okay, you are so not really ready for that, so not there yet. Whereas with SlideShare, I think followed was, you know, much more of a, you know, build something with no funding, you know, and they had that first, and then the angel funding, and then the venture funding. On the other hand,
slideshow at a party recently, and some mutual acquaintance, so I don't even remember who, was like, oh, Rashmi's going to be on your panel? Slideshare's not a lean startup. They're not following all the lean things. And of course, just like a lot of things, people are going to have their different opinions and definitions of what's lean and all that kind of stuff. So you're an entrepreneur. What is your take on all this?
So, lean startup, the term, put it into perspective, but I think we were that right from the beginning. When we launched SlideShare, we had another product before that, and we spent a year building it and then put it out into the market and realized that like maybe 60% of what we built wasn't needed. So when we thought of SlideShare, we thought it up in April 2006, started working on it with one engineer and our CTO. Launched it in October 2006. It just kind of immediately took off, and then we just kept on working on it. So right from the day one, we just kind of built something, first prototype, we started giving it to people. People put up more things than we'd expected and just took off from there.
So the original product, would you say, there's the term some people use in this old logic called pivot, where you have some idea, and before raising $10 million from Sequoia, you try something out and get some actual learning from it and then think, okay, we got to adjust it. Was that what happened with this first thing that you built that morphed into what SlideShare is today?
Correct. And we weren't even planning to take venture funding at that point, to be honest. We were just, doing our thing. We had another product. We were making money from it. We were profitable as a company. So this was just kind of, our plaything that we built. And it was only after about 8 or 9 months when it started, we could no longer keep up with it. We were making some money from day one because of AdSense. So in the beginning, we were like, oh, this is fun, but then it just took off in a life of its own, and then we had to, kind of decide that, well, we will have to take funding for this in order to grow it and live up to its promise. But by the time we took funding, we had 4 million uniques, so we were fairly, good size by that time.
What would be some actual practical concrete tips, it's mostly an entrepreneurial audience here, for employing these techniques? I mean, everybody can read Stephen's book and read Eric Ries' blog, but if you're actually going to try doing this kind of stuff, what are some of the practical tips to try to actually put this into practice?
Sure. The first thing I would say that if you really want to learn about Lean Startup and not go to that thick book, go to SlideShare and look up slideshare.net/sgblank. Steve's presentations are on the site. And so are Eric Ries and Sean Ellis and everybody who does, Lean Startup stuff. So, the second thing, talking from a personal perspective, I would say don't put too much effort into any one, one feature, one sub-product or anything. Think of what it is. I always say build enough to get the concept out there, that the user, when they encounter it, they should be able to get the concept, their core concept, and then see what happens and iterate. And that does mean that there's a lot of other things you can do. For example, it's very difficult for us typically to do kind of these product announcements because we're putting out things when they are at a very early stage within. So you kind of forego all that. And for the first time after, I would say, 2 years, we did actually a product launch where we actually did a little bit of press. And it felt so hard to us because it's awful trying to iterate with a product when you have to keep it quiet and secret and you can't talk about it. Instead, doing it out in the open, just listening to your, customers every day. I love the fact that...
I have a question on that.
Yeah.
Do you talk to your frequent flyers?
Yes, we do. Yeah, we talk to our customers pretty much every day. I personally, interact with many of them. It's helpful that many of them, like me, are speakers, so I know them professionally. But I even require that on our customer feedback site, all the engineers have logins there. And every once in a while, we expect them to directly go and talk to the customers there.
Are you using user voice or get satisfaction?
We use Zendesk, get satisfaction, email, Twitter,
mm-hmm.
Everything. A number of different
avenues. Any other tools that you're using to maintain these customer relationships?
I think I listed pretty much all of them.
So,
yeah.
So I think the telephone's a really good one. I think a lot of software engineers are introverted, and there's this desire to have a kind of a programmed interaction with your prospects, your customers. And the problem is you can't be surprised if you give somebody a multiple choice test. And so we're huge fans of conversation with prospects and with customers. I'm glad to hear that Rushmi is doing that because I think that's essential.
So customer data is inversely valuable by the distance from their eyeballs, is the way you should think about it. You know, any type of customer data is great, but I kind of start with, if you're not watching their pupils dilate, that's probably the best, and it doesn't mean you've got to go do that all the time, but I just to kind of second or third this, you know, for me, customer development is about continuous customer interaction. Just as an aside, those of you who are engineers, you know, one of the ironies is, of course, the customer development process is a methodology, and therefore engineers love it, but the real truth is entrepreneurship is not a spreadsheet run from the building, right? It's not. That's why it's still an art, and all of you are artists. And what the methodology is about and what eyeball and customer contact is about is to basically feed your pattern recognizer that you're running with real-time data that's not filtered by your fantasies, right? One of the great things about an entrepreneur is you're either doing one or two things about your startup. You're either hallucinating or you have a vision. And only time will tell.
I don't think you or any of your investors, the people who invested or the people who turned you down, have any idea which it is.
Until the liquidity event. So I just want to riff on what Sean and Rashmi were saying, is that you know, this constant customer contact, whether it's, you know, testing, A/B testing, etc. And I just wanted to riff. Because I read a lot now about, gee, we're going to do A/B tests, and we're going to do lots of A/B tests, and we're going to do more A/B tests. I think that's the engineer speaking. You know, I kind of laugh when I see, you know, we're going to A/B test whether the button is, you know, 17 pixels or 15 pixels. And why I think that's fun, and it'll make you feel like you're making progress, and it might actually change some click-through rates. That's not what customer development is about. I mean, you could do that, and I'm glad you do. But customer development is realizing, wait a minute, our business is over here. And that's, you know, the insight about getting outside the building. And I think that's the example that we just heard about SlideShare. It was that kind of insight. And it was realizing that you had actually built something more valuable that wasn't even your main product line.
Yeah, absolutely. And even we just launched some business features, which was basically the ability to collect customer leads through your presentations. And we didn't dream this up. You know, it sounds kind of intelligent and intuitive when you hear about it, but we didn't. We basically observed that that's what people were doing on the site. They would withhold the downloading of the PowerPoint and then say, email me if you want to download this document. And then they would have these conversations. So they said, oh, that's what's going on. So we built around that. So just kind of constantly, you know, looking, talking, hearing people. I would say that's a huge thing.
Cool. Well, it's almost a quarter to, and I think we're going around 8:15. I want to try to allow like at least 30 minutes for questions. So I'm going to open up to questions in a second. Before I do that, I'm just going to list a few back to sort of practical stuff. I always like to try to, you know, have this not be all pie in the sky and practical. So here are just some resources that I want to recommend. So one is Eric Reese's blog, and he's somebody I've already mentioned. And I think I already mentioned it, startuplessonslearned.com. Sean Ellis is another guy who does a lot of stuff in this. He's sort of a marketing consultant guy. I work with some really cool companies and into all this stuff. His blog is startup-marketing.com and covers a lot of similar ground and has some really interesting stuff. Steve Blank's blog is, oddly enough, steveblank.com and has a lot of interesting stuff, including some really interesting self-deprecating stories about his career. VentureHacks.com is a site that you guys, any entrepreneur should be reading about this topic. And they have had a lot of stuff about lean startups, minimal viable product, and a lot of these topics, but much a lot of other stuff you should know. Y Combinator, Hacker News, which is sort of a dig for this kind of stuff, a site that I would recommend everybody check out every day. It's news.ycombinator.com. Of course, Steve's book, Despite the Pain, I still recommend reading it, and then also all the slides on SlideShare and the blogs, and then maybe, you know, it's easier to make sense of it. I think there's even some videos of some of these guys speaking. I also recommend, just for now, a little nerdy one, Slicehost is a good web host for really early stage. You can start off with $20 a month for basically a virtual Linux server, and it's a great way of prototyping and testing some idea that you have. $20 a month, and you've got a site up there, up and running to start with, and then scale up from that. And then there's also a Lean Startup Circle Google group, which if you Google Lean Startup Circle, that has a lot of interesting discussion around these topics
could
that
show
you can join.
Could you show it? How many folks are in the Lean Startup Circle Google group? Okay.
So a few.
Oh, good. Okay.
A few. So those are just some tips from me. And now I want to open it up to questions. And do we have anybody with a mic or something for the questions, or no? Where is Chris?
Then stand up and talk.
You have to speak up.
Okay, so whoever has a question, I'll point to you, stand up, and then yell your question. And then also just do me one favor, which is we have very limited time and such a great panel. Try to be concise as possible in your question. So I'll start with you.
So I'd like to know the difference. You know, you talked a little bit about the tools that are coming up, user voice, get satisfaction, and so forth. So I'd love to know, Steve in particular, how much is that going to be a sort of crutch that people rely on to say, okay, now I'm doing my customer development because I have these online tools that I think are convenient and can be very useful, but keep you in the building. They don't actually have you talking with people and getting that eyeball contact. So do you see those tools as being better for entrepreneurs?
So did everybody hear the question, or do you want me to rephrase it, repeat it? You all heard it?
Yeah, so I think the question is, do automated tools hurt or help a customer development process? And I kind of flip it around and give you a marketing answer. Is I think they're part of a customer development process, but they're not the sum of it. So let me make a declarative sentence. If that's all you're doing, you're not doing customer development. Because at the end, you have no validity check on the data. And I tend to believe that you gather data at multiple levels, from eyeball to using these automated tools, which I think are awesome, you know, to making sure you understand industry surveys and market share and all kinds of data. So I tend to think of God's eye view being all market share data, size of market, total available market, you know, automated tools, and then some segment of eyeballing, or at least a way that telephoning is to me, and I agree with Sean, that, you know, if you can't physically eyeball, and I'm not suggesting all of them, but there ought to be some kind of percentage that allows you to check your data. Is that
John? Yeah, no, I had a conversation with a gentleman in Chicago from the Lean Startup Circle, and he said his best idea for a company was he would never have to interact with his customers or prospects. I said, you're not going to win, because somebody's going to learn faster than you, and there's this desire for a kind of friction-free live in your bubble.
And in fact, the corollary to this, the other bad corollary, is saying, oh, I get customer development or agile and lean, I'm just going to hire somebody to go do this. And I don't mean a coach like Sean, but I mean I'm going to hire a VP of sales and tell them to go do this. Let me be clear, at least for me, if the founders aren't doing this, you're not doing it. Why? Because human nature says if someone tells you your baby's ugly, you know, you're not going to believe it. But if you hear it directly, that is, a VP of sales says, oh, they're not buying, you know what your first reaction is? You're not at explaining it well enough. It's normal human nature. You have to be doing this yourself, and that's the other fallacy of let's just do this automated. You need to be connected to the process, because it will make you think. It will force you to deal with the data rather than rationalize the data.
Sorry. In every dysfunctional company that I've worked at, and I've worked at a few, we've actually not been suffering from the problem of lack of customer insight. We just ignored it, or there was political management issues. I mean, I've been in companies where we had, you know, a software product, and it was full of bugs. The customers just wanted us to fix that, and instead we were working on the 4.0 version that was going to have even more bugs and be completely compatible, and they didn't want that, and there was enough people in the company in the building who knew this, but we just didn't act on it, or the site was too slow or whatever. So I've actually seen a lot of companies where we know what's going on, or half the company does, or the engineers, or this guy does, and it's just ignored, or not acted upon, or not executed upon. I've just seen that in a shocking number of startups, where we know, and we just don't want to face it.
I just want to mention one tool, which I'd forgotten earlier, usertesting.com, where you can get videos of users, and it's a very quick way to do usability testing, and
awesome.
You know, just getting some feedback. Live usability testing is even better when you do it yourself. But this is, you know, you can just put it out there and in the night get your feedback and look at it next day.
it can be one of the most painful experiences.
I mean, we talked about how venture-backed companies like to spend money. I've been at companies I founded, and once you have the venture money, you need the fancy VP of marketing, and they want to do focus groups, and they can spend so much money on this stuff. But if you just have, you know, five of your friends come over to your house or office and use your site, and of course, they're not even the right people, because they're still really not typical people. They're way too close. But nonetheless, if you do this at a cost of zero, and then and you're not allowed to say anything, you ask them to show them you how they use your site or product, and you are not allowed to talk. You just watch while somebody else uses it in front of you while you watch. You can learn so much for zero, even though they're still not the perfect people. It's still a way to see something that so often you're missing. And I think, as you mentioned, with the online tools only, you're actually going to miss a lot, because you're still not really going to see when the person like can't find this stuff and is swearing and going like this and all things. That's not going to be in sort of the online tool only. Way at the back, gentlemen.
Yeah, question for Rob. When you do the quick arcade
Can't hear you.
How much of the company does the quick arcade or million to buy and give you? Back to the control question.
You want to know how much first round, what percent of the company they take for that average $600,000 investment?
Well, that depends on the valuation.
There we go. There's your answer. I'm not sure you're in the right room.
I think he's asking on average. I think the more interesting question would be, you know, if you followed these techniques and you actually got a shitload of traction and proof and evidence before you chase VC money, until you've really got something that's working, and then they come to you, you know, how much more of your company are you going to keep, or what other benefits are you going to have? I mean, how much better a deal are you going to have if you've done that? Are there ways to on average, you know, improve the situation to the benefit of the founders?
Thank you. That was my question.
I mean, it matters a lot, right? So two guys with an idea, well, are probably not going to get funded, right? Two known guys with an idea. And by the way, I use guy as a guy can be any gender, or sexual orientation or whatever. It's just two guys, right? Two guys from Italy, I don't freaking care. So two guys that are very well known and have had a lot of success before are going to get a better valuation. You know, two guys that have developed something that has real customers, I mean, so it spans the range, right? So if it's two guys that have started something and they're doing $10 million in revenue, they're going to have a really high valuation. As a matter of fact, they're going to probably be beyond where we're able to invest, right? Because they're going to go straight to Benchmark or whoever. So it's one of those questions where there's a range. I mean, you know, and there's the kind of low point is where it doesn't make sense from a founder point of view to even take the money, because they're going to be so diluted after the first round that they're not going to be motivated. And no investor worth their salt would actually make that investment.
Has anybody seen that Shark Tank TV show on ABC? It's sort of like Dragon's Den. They're like, I will give you $10,000 for 90% of your company. I can't even watch it. Okay, Steve, I think, has a tip for us how to maximize our valuation.
Let me give you some concrete examples, and I'd be interested in Rob's experience. But we've used this in some of the startups I advised who were doing customer development. And the slide presentation looks like this. You know, A slide, you talk about who you are, B slide, you know, here's our market. But then the next slides break the entire mold of VC pitches. And they go like this. Here's what we thought, here's what we did, and here's what we found. Next slide. Then here's what we thought. Then here's what we did. Then we're, and on each slide was a graph of revenue. Okay? And by the third slide, you know, hopefully you have more than three of those, there's a noticeable uptick in revenue. And let me tell you, it screws with, excuse me, VC's heads in 20 ways. One is, I know I got a team that actually understands how to take customer input. Two, the graph tells me they understand what's important, users, revenue, or whatever. And three is, this is a team capable of learning and iterating rapidly. Now, you walk into a VC firm like that, I call this a uranium enrichment process. Meaning, no, seriously, it's taking raw feedstock, which is I'm a techie or I'm a marketeer and I have an idea, and now I'm like connecting it to an iterative loop that says, hey, by the way, and if you give me money, that graph on the right is still going to, you know, go up. And I have a process that like is pretty simple to understand, And I never had to sell you about customer development or Agile, or we didn't have to talk about Lean. All I had to do is, in fact, show you I'm executing the religion, not evangelize the religion. And that's a major distinction. I have to tell you how many times I've like got to sit in presentations and somebody say, let me tell you about this thing called Lean Startups. And I'm not particularly interested in what you know. This isn't the class. What I'm interested in is what have you done with the knowledge? And what you should have done with the knowledge is, I had an idea. Oh, man, was I off. But here's what I did. And here's what, and that's what the process looks like in a venture firm. Yeah. Ralph, does that help or hurt if somebody comes in like that?
Oh, no, that would be great. I would love that. that would be.
John? I have one quick elaboration on the bootstrapping to your question, which is, if you bootstrap for your break-even, then the conversation that says we're a break-even revenue or better means that there's no negotiating window. If you show up on the VC's doorstep and say, we're going to be out of money in 4 months, guess when the negotiation starts? About 4 months and one day.
So don't go into VC and have slides about how we love lean startups. Learn the techniques, use it, and then go in with the evidence.
And there's one other tried and true way to get your valuation up, if that's what you want to do, and that's to make sure you have more than one VC at the table. Right? You have more than one VC at the table.
Auction.
Right? So the second that someone else wants to invest in that company, your valuation has just gone up. If five people want to invest in that company, you can basically tell them what the valuation is going to be.
Yeah.
Right? And so that, I'll tell you what, if you come in with the slides that Steve is talking about, and you explain your method, you explain what you've done and what it's proven, then you're going to have five firm sheets.
If you are not a famous entrepreneur and you go in with something that doesn't have anything proven, you might find some guy, and I'm going to use guy to some guy on Santa Road. You might find one guy who said, you know what, this is really interesting. I see your vision. I see something there. I'm interested. I'm going to give you a term sheet. And at that point, you're going to probably be at the mercy of whatever valuation they feel like. If you are further along, if you've done this building, this testing, this validation, this learning, that's a much more likely situation that you're now going to be in a position where you're not relying on somebody's sort of random gut instinct getting them all excited. You're going to actually go in and show something that maybe half of Santa Road would look at and be like, yeah, okay, no brainer. And that's when you're going to get the competitive pressure on your valuation.
Does that hold for angels as well?
No, I really don't think it does. I think angels typically are investing on their gut. Hopefully angels are investing because of the personal relationship or because you're doing something that they're an entrepreneur who did a company like that before, and they look at it and they are able to rely on their insights, hopefully. But it also, an example of SlideShare, when I invested in SlideShare as an angel, I had already used the product as a customer before I even knew them. So, that helped a lot. And it would have been a different situation if I had actually known them. Some people say, I'm not going to be able to get funding because I didn't go to Stanford and I don't know a lot of people. Well, there are other things he can then do to make up for that.
Does the auction idea work for angels?
No, because angels are not going to take the whole deal together. Angels, you're going to build a syndicate together. So that's a pretty different situation. Yes?
So the maths of the idea of that's not always the case. I mean, Y Combinator is a good example where they'll invest at a $600,000 valuation, and several of the companies will then get their subsequent round at a three million, or maybe a higher valuation, or maybe a lower valuation too. Is there a different model for venture capital where VC takes the lean startup approach and works in short cycles and looks to make smaller returns over short periods, which then compound up to the equivalent over the longer term?
Well, I think that's sort of what Rockwood First Round is doing. I mean, they are making, it's a smaller fund, their math isn't quite as...
But I mean, sorry,
I think the question was, is there some model for leaner VCs that are not having to have these gigantic, huge exits?
It goes a bit further than that, because it's not just leaner VCs, but it's VCs exiting earlier.
decided, Y Combinator does not sell out to that A round guy.
I know, it does.
Their investment's writing. So they're still in the to be determined case of what that's valuable, right? And the second round investor does not want to buy out the first round investor because that money is not going to drive the valuation. That's not going to drive the value of the company.
But why? So if the value of the company is so critical.
Yeah. I mean,
it's not going to be used to create value. In other words, if they give you $1 million, you turn around and take $500,000 of it, into their perspective, set fire to it. It doesn't do you any good.
The question is a little off topic, and this can happen. And there's one VC, I'm forgetting, who wrote a topic on I think he called it like a new model for exits or liquidity. Does somebody remember?
Founders Fund is doing a little bit.
No, but there's one of the popular VC bloggers who wrote a post about this whole thing because who? Inspiration? Yeah, I'm not talking about him. I'm talking about the somebody who's not following this model who just wrote a blog post about it. Maybe Brad Feld or somebody.
Fred Wilson.
Maybe it was Fred Wilson. But it's a little beyond the scope. And the reality is, actually, I think maybe we'd like to do an event sometimes about founder liquidity, secondary markets, that whole kind of thing. I think that'd be an interesting topic, but a little outside the scope of the lean startup. You, yes, with glasses and the white shirt.
Question for Steve. So I wanted to make, with regards to the customer development process, so if you imagine there's some companies that they have an idea, they build a product, and then their mission is to go sell that product. And then there are some companies that, well, I identify a problem, my mission is to solve that problem, and it may not be by way of their product. So is customer development more about developing the customer and solving that problem, or is it more about developing the customer to use your product, or is it a combination of both?
I guess if I had a vote, I'd say none of the above. Customer development, at least when I was writing it, was about how to temper entrepreneurs' passion for executing their vision. You know, if you're a world-class entrepreneur, you can't wait to go build your product because you are right, right? Or else, who the hell would like do something where the odds of making serious money is 1 out of 1,000? Would any of you get on an airplane to go to New York if you knew that like you only 1 out of 100 would actually get there? I mean, that's, no, seriously. And so the whole purpose of customer development is entrepreneurs are wired to execute. What I'm evangelizing is counter to your intuition and passion. And by the way, just as an aside, this whole customer development thing, it's a model. It is not the model. You know, you should hear it from me. You know, there are 50 other models. The problem is no one has bothered to write them down. Smack on Sand Hill Road. But, you know, this happened to be the one.
By your analogy, the venture industry basically, you know, is an industry where you get paid millions of dollars to run an airline where 99% of your planes crash.
Right. And since most of them are living off the management fees and the billion-dollar funds, they have no motivation to do anything else. But that's another subject. So specifically, customer development, not at your firm. If you have billions under management and there's no liquidity and you're getting 2% management fees, which most VCs have, and you used to make money because you had smaller funds like Rob, and you made it off the 20% carry, which was the 20% profit when your entrepreneurs were liquid. Now, because there's no exit, you happen to say, well, screw them. I just get to write 2% checks to ourselves, and let's see, over $1 billion.
That's why the venture industry grew.
Right. So, but anyway, back to your question. The rationale for customer development was entrepreneurs have their neurons hardwired to get out and execute. There's nothing wrong with having that passion. And what I wanted to insert was simply two or three additional neurons that said, maybe you're wrong. Oh, how do I actually not slow down that passion? Because if you remember, what I talk about was, I don't want you to go out and do the world's biggest focus group. Customer development is simply of, hey, is my hypothesis correct or not? Don't slow down engineering. Don't slow down development. Just make sure that your vision, as you're out executing it, is it right? And all I suggest is take all your hypotheses that are in your plan and turn them into questions. rather than declarative statements. That's the function of customer development. It is not how to, it's not the customer creation part, which is how do I evangelize customers. So if you think about the first two steps, customer discovery and customer validation, that's kind of that iterative loop about am I right before I scale this business and burn a ton of money. That's all it's about, and I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's great.
Okay.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely.
That was interesting. So you mentioned how this is this Lean Startup approach and customer development approach, it's not the only approach, and I'm glad you said that, because it seems like every time a young entrepreneur asks me for advice, whatever this is the one thing they've heard of, they think, you know, it's the only model. Always get VC. No, never get VC. Cloud computing only. This only.
It's
thing.
It's
and
why
saying,
this is an art.
Yeah,
this business is an art. It's not a science, right? All these methodologies are is to give you a map rather than a drunken walk around the pole. And if this is a better map than the one you could come up with, great. If not, make up your own, because that's what most people have been doing before we had this. And so I know Eric doesn't say this is the way. No way. I mean, because there are guys who will serve women who will swing for the fence, and look at that, they made Google. You know, by the way, when I remind my class at Stanford, does anybody know what the revenue model for Google was for the first 3 years? They didn't have one.
Well, there's another sort of trendy thing now, especially because we're in a sort of a bursting of the bubble. Ad rates are down. All the VCs hate advertising as a business model right now. It's sort of going from one extreme to the other. And there's certain bloggers and people who espouse this approach, and it's not a bad one. Is make money right away, and you go from the extreme of thinking like let's not even think about a business model ever and just get tons of VC funding to another extreme of it's not interesting at all unless you have an instant business model from the get-go, which of course is not a bad idea at all, but it shouldn't be the only example. So aside from Google, are there any examples of a company that if they had tried to follow this advice and test their hypotheses, would have probably decided to give up and not do something that ended up being extremely successful? Right. Are there any contrarian examples? Well, we still don't know if Twitter is going to make a jury.
But I think the Twitter example is Twitter started as something else, right?
Yeah.
This was the side project.
It was a side project.
So in fact, to the fact that they paid attention to their customers, I happen to have a personal belief that part of customer development is figuring out whether there's a viable revenue model on day one. And you could conclude, no, it's a freemium model is the one we're going to bet on, and here's the evidence, or here's what I believe. Or, and let me just... put an overall umbrella on this, I tend to believe that entrepreneurs start with a faith-based vision. It's all faith, right? Unless you're a domain expert coming from this exact company on Friday and taking the source code, just leaving on Monday, it's all faith. The process of both customer development and agile development is very quickly to replace that faith and each tenant in the faith with facts. That's all this is. Instead of just blindly executing every component on faith. And if you do that and you're unlucky, like 999 out of 1,000, you end up with 12 salespeople with one in Boston burning, N dollars and out of business or getting a cram down round. This is just a substitute for continuing faith-based process.
Well, that's another thing we haven't mentioned. People were getting after questions about valuation, which is sort of beyond the scope of this panel. But I think one thing that happens, not just outright failure, when you get ahead of yourself, when you haven't tested your hypotheses, what is the right word?
Hypotheses.
When
guesses.
You haven't tested
your
guesses.
You only get to use hypotheses when you paid for business school,
I did not go to business school. So you haven't tested your guesses, you raise a bunch of VC money, and then you find out after you've ramped up the cost structure, diluted the cap table, and spent a lot of time and money, that things aren't quite there. And you do pivot, but by that point, now you need new money, and now you're going to have to do a recap or cram down or something. There's a lot of companies that follow this path. So by the time the company does maybe actually end up with an exit someday, 5 years later, the people who are there early are pretty much washed out and get nothing. So that's another reason it might be better to test these things and figure out the pivots and things that you need to do before you take on all that cash structure.
I just want to point out, to me, the whole book from Steve Blank, the most useful thing has really been about that. You know, not to put sales ahead of the product. I kind of instinctively believed in it, but it was very useful to convince, you know, our VCs and get everybody on the board for the fact that, you know, we need to first figure this out, figure out the mechanics of this before doing these projections and how big we're going to get and hiring all these salespeople. And it's been very useful for that.
Liz, do we have time for any more questions, or are we out of time or what? Two more questions. Okay, yes.
For the panel, what do you consider the difference between lean and starving?
Dinner.
an understanding spouse.
I think lean is by choice. Lean is by choice. You know, we work very hard to stay scrappy even after taking funding, and, you know, just be very scrappy in our approach to everything. So.
And sometimes they're the same thing, right? I mean, you know, we talk about, I mean, you always hear about companies that are kind of ramen profitable, we call that, right? Which means they're not paying themselves and they're eating ramen and they're profitable, right? So is that lean or is that starving? It depends on if you like ramen. Right. So
let me put it in the context of the four steps. If you remember, step two is customer validation. And the goal in customer validation is to find a repeatable and scalable business model. And so to me, you're lean until you find something scalable. And when you find something scalable, you grab Rob by the collar and then turn him upside down and get all the money you can. Because what you have just proven is that if you add one N of sales and marketing, you could get 2N or 3N of revenue. So you want, whether it's lean or starving, to a point, and then not be stupid. The goal isn't to be lean and starving to end up with a $5 million revenue company. The goal is to end up with a hockey stick. But it's that iterative process till you find that repeatable and scalable model, and then you want to be a cash-rich company with all the resources to actually scale a model you have tested and found repeatable. Does that?
At what percent of companies funded in the last 5 years took in VC money before actually getting that point?
That's the mistake is, in fact, not lean versus starving, but overfed. Because every startup I've ever, and I've been incredibly guilty of this, you never underspend the rounds you raise. Somehow you magically manage to staff, hire, building, furniture, whatever, exactly, you know, 10% over the last round. And there's no metrics to stop you from doing that. Customer development model just gives you a set of benchmarks and metrics. Don't spend money on this stuff until there's something repeatable and scalable, or you believe that.
I mean, the example of Twitter was brought up, and Twitter spun out of Odeo. Odeo was going to be podcasting. The founders weren't really that even into podcasting, as Evan Freely admits now, and they raised a bunch of venture money and ended up giving it back. So, you know, I think if you see a company that burns through, you know, $10 million without ever getting the traction, that means they didn't. That's not really lean. You didn't figure out any of this stuff, you know, beforehand.
Well, and they shouldn't have raised $10 million.
Right, but I've seen. I mean, the number of. I mean, I know so many people, and you know, between and Paul Graham from Y Combinator wrote a post about this, you know, pointing out. I mean, the whole more capital efficient startups are cheaper thing. I mean, Joe Kress wrote about that, you know, way back, and Paul Graham wrote a post basically saying, you know, even though it's been cheaper for a while now. You know, for several years though, the VC floodgates opened again, so people took it because it was there. And I know a million people who, you know, raised $10 million and, you know, burned through it around 2 years with a product that nobody ever wanted, and then the company shut down. That's probably going to be happening less now. I'm not sure that's a bad thing for entrepreneurs or VCs, but, you know, I've been seeing that a lot. Last question.
I have an idea for Steve's next book. I think it should be called Taxpayer Development. I'm wondering if you could apply any of these principles to
do you even have a comment to that?
No. Though I am a public, I am a California state official. I'm a coastal commissioner, so I will pass that on to the governor next time.
Actually, Eric Reese spoke at a government conference about a month ago on that topic.
Right.
So the government is looking into ways to use these principles, whether to implement them.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, the financial collapse was very much like what happens at a company that raises a ton of VC money and wasn't really ready for it and never can sort of meet the throttle now of expectations set by that. You know, it's sort of a house of cards. And that you know, that we've seen these bubbles when you've got a ton of startups whose primary revenue source is the venture funding from other startups, which I've seen now in 99 and then, you know, a few recently. That's not sustainable, but it's similar to what we saw with the
financial system. We have a benign VC in China.
It keeps funding. Oh, it keeps funding us. The Sovereign Wealth Fund? Yeah. Okay, well, on that interesting note, I guess the net is don't run your startup like the government. Because you know what? As an entrepreneur, nobody's going to bail you out. Not the government and not your VCs. You're just going to be recapped or shut down. So,
yeah.
On that note, thank you everybody for coming. Thank you very much to our panelists. And Julie Godward, thank you, Julie.
Copyright on this. Is there a copyright on this?
On what?